Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. You can find more podcasts like this by searching for EDUCAUSE on iTunes or visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts.
Good morning. I'm convening the session, Collaborating with Vendors Toward Improved Accessibility. My name is Julie Jurens. I want to introduce to you the three speakers for this session: Terrell Thompson, University of Washington; John Gunderson, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign; and Ken Petrie from the Ohio State University. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming this morning. I'm curious, how many of you are actually vendors? Let's see a show of hands. Okay. So about half or maybe more than half. And the rest of you, how many are not vendors? Okay. So I think that should, if you add those two together, then we should have the total number of people here. So I think we're pretty close anyway. Obviously, we're a fairly small group, so we'd like to certainly have the opportunity for everybody to share their thoughts and to have a dialogue. That said, we did put together some thoughts of our own, so we'll go through the slides and then leave plenty of opportunity at the end to talk or have questions answered, that sort of thing. So each of us has been involved in collaborative efforts at some level with vendors, and so we kind of wanted to share that experience with you all today. And we're specifically talking about collaboration related to accessibility. And the reason that we focus on that is simply because 10% of students in higher education actually self-identify and register as having disabilities. So I think there might be some who are surprised at how high that percentage is. There are several sources, actually, that support that. Some statistics within the federal government. And When we're talking about people with disabilities, we're talking about a variety of different characteristics. Folks who are unable to see, maybe using screen readers or braille output devices, people who are unable to hear, people who are unable to use a mouse, people who are unable to perceive color. And note that these are all people with disabilities fall into these categories, but other people do too. So we talk a lot about universal design. For example, for somebody who's unable to hear, it might be somebody who's deaf or hard of hearing, but it might also be somebody who's in a lab where they don't have sound output, or for various other situational reasons, they need some alternative to audio. The same could be argued for all of those categories. We have, as higher education institutions, we have legal and ethical requirements to make sure that our programs and services are accessible. That goes all the way back to 1973. The Section 508 of the Rehab Act required that recipients of federal funding ensure that their programs and services are accessible. And that same principles is built into the Americans with Disabilities Act in 1990, which also expanded coverage. So you didn't just have to be a recipient of federal funding, but you still had to ensure that programs and services are accessible. And there are state laws and campus policies that require sort of that same thing. So as we deliver programs and services with technology and all the sorts of tools that we're seeing here at EDUCAUSE, then we need to make sure that they're accessible and that we're going to meet our ADA and Section 504 requirements by using these tools. So a lot of people talk also about Section 508, so we'll talk about that here, and it actually plays a key role in the work that we do with vendors. Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act, it's that same Rehabilitation Act from 1973, it was amended in 1998, and the amendments required that the federal government ensure that its electronic and information technology, whether that be something it developed, something that it purchased, just something that it uses, has to be accessible. And since that then is federal law, then they needed to come up with some standards that specifically define what information technology accessibility is. And so those standards were developed shortly after the law was passed. In December of 2000, these were written into the law. And they are all the categories that you see here, six categories of information technology. There are accessibility standards for each. Software applications and operating systems, web-based intranet and internet information and applications, telecommunication products, video and multimedia products, self-contained closed products, such as information kiosks, those sort of things, standalone devices, as well as desktop and portable computers. And that then led to the development of a voluntary product accessibility template, or VPAT. And note the word voluntary there, that this is a tool that allows vendors to sort of self-assess and define how accessible they are on a variety of different checkpoints, you know, all the different criteria that make up the standard. And so as vendors do this, that then gives people who are purchasing information technology some sort of gauge as to whether the product they're purchasing is accessible or not. Now, the problem with VPATs is that they're not always super informative, and sometimes they can be a little bit misleading. So I wanted to give a couple of examples. We'll give examples both good and bad. We're not going to name names, those vendors who are sitting there nervously. This is an example of a VPAT that's uninformative. It's uninformative for you because it's very small and you can't see it. But this is, that's why I'm going to describe it. Software applications and operating systems is the category that this product falls under. And in the way a VPAT typically works is you have a Section 508 checkpoint. In this case, within the software category, you've got all the Section 508 accessibility criteria listed. And then you have a column for supporting features and a column for remarks where the vendor then can elaborate on you know, how they meet or do not meet a particular criteria. So the idea behind this is this would be very informative. Somebody can really get a good sense for how a product meets the accessibility criteria. In this case, supporting features is filled out the same for every single checkpoint. And what it says is, product has been coded to meet this standard subject to the remarks on the right. But then as you see in the far right column, there are no remarks. So we really have nothing, based on this VPAT, we can't tell anything about this product in terms of its accessibility. The second example here is one where we have a summary table that lists all of the different categories of information technology according to Section 508. Software, web, telecommunication, video, etc. And this particular product is a wireless mobile device that's used for telecommunication, but it also has a variety of software applications that it can be used on. I'm not naming any names here. It's also capable of displaying video. But as we look at the categories here, under software applications and operating systems, it says not applicable. Under web-based internet and intranet and internet information applications, not applicable. Video multimedia products, not applicable. Desktop and portable computers, which it arguably is, not applicable. So they didn't really recognize that their product transcends all of these categories and really, you know, should be looking at accessibility from the vantage point of all these different categories. That information just simply wasn't provided. So we do have an example of a good VPAT. And Ken is going to talk about this one.
We can name the name of this one. This is from Desire to Learn's voluntary product accessibility template. And the reason I feel that I should mention it by name is because I'm going to talk about them later, so you're going to figure it out anyway. This particular VPAT, I think, came about in a way that was unique and that gets us into the discussion about collaboration. We have a small consortium that meets regularly with people from Desire to Learn, and one of the products of our collaboration was this VPAT. They took an initial stab at it, and the rest was workshopped, and we helped with the final editing. As edited collaboratively. One of the things that's different about this particular VPAT than the others that we've looked at is the detail. And I don't know, it's not legible. really. So let me just talk about, by way of contrast, the first criteria. So the first criteria in 508 is a text equivalent for every non-text element. So the alt text requirement. That's the first item that you see up there. And they say that they support with exceptions. And so they give both remarks and exceptions in the right-hand side. And they refer to particular ways that they implement this standard, areas that it applies to, and then areas that it might fall short on. And I think that because of the fact that this was workshopped, I can tell you from experience that this particular VPAT is entirely honest about where the environment complies and where it doesn't comply. I guess that brings me to one other point, and that's even if you have a very rich VPAT, how do you know that the product is being represented fairly in the VPAT? Because the way a lot of these VPATs function, not for the two prior ones so much, because those were really negative examples, but you'll see some that it says complies, and it gives a couple of remarks, and everything looks hunky dory, and you're thinking that this particular product is golden. So how do you know whether or not a voluntary product accessibility template is worth the paper that it's written on? And the answer kind of is you don't. What you can do as an institution is recruit local talent to determine whether or not this is accurate. So a VPAT probably shouldn't determine whether or not you're going to purchase a particular product, but it can give you a sense of the environment within the company that produced the document. This is one that is obviously very rich. It's well formatted. It's very full. It contains a long preamble that talks about the company's commitment to accessibility, and I think it's a model for how these VPATs ought to be.
Okay, well, what do we really want for accessibility? We've talked about VPATs, but oftentimes, how many people we have from companies here? Who fills out the VPATs for your company? Is it the marketing people or the technical people? Product management, okay. Well, one of the things that we've done with our collaborations with many companies, one of the things that we found is that companies basically build products and then they start testing for accessibility, kind of accessible repair. We build something, and at near the end of the process, they basically start looking at, well, okay, somebody said we have to fill out this accessibility thing or we should test for accessibility. And it's not uncommon. It happens with web development, even internally in higher education and other places. But that pattern of work really does a number of things. One, accessibility is kind of always looked at as a burden because we want to get the product out, and now we have to do this accessibility stuff. We made design decisions that weren't very good for accessibility. So now we have to try to do what we can to fix up the problems and then try to, put it out the door. It's not a good time. So we work with companies, just like we want to work with web developers, we want to get to people at design time. What are the features that we're building into this product so that it is accessible? And accessible not only to people with disabilities, but hopefully more accessible and flexible for everybody to use. What is the internal quality assurance process? Once you have design patterns you want your developers to use, how does your QA process ensure that people are using those design patterns as they build new features and that they modify code and do things? Quality assurance, with a lot of products now, people do testing with users. They bring in users to make sure it works. Are people with disabilities included as part of that user base? Are you ensuring that internally you understand the accessibility of the product? and in user interface design and testing. So in the prototyping process, are people with disabilities considered as a part of that process? You know, are you bringing people in with different types of disabilities to ask, to look at, well, how is this feature going to impact them? How are they going to be able to use it? If I can't use a mouse, how is somebody who can only use the keyboard going to do this particular, use this particular feature that I'm working on? How efficient will it be? Next slide. Some of the other areas, too, that are really important, how is accessibility features documented in your product? So, for example, if you're a content a learning management system and somebody needs to have extended times for tests, how does, so, you know, you have students and it's a time test that most people get an hour, but students with disabilities maybe get time and a half. So is it easy to add that? Who has to do it? Those are some of the features and thinking that we want to think about in design time, but also to provide documentation, so to make it easier for accommodations to be made for students with disabilities, with maybe not their instructor not even having to know about it. Some privacy. And I think support is also critical. When people with disabilities call into your companies or call into a company or advocates for those people, that people understand what they're talking about when they talk about assistive technologies or some of the other accessibility features, so that their accessibility problems don't get lost because there's so few of them. And, you know, it's oftentimes difficult to get people with disabilities to report problems, because what most people with disabilities will do is just find a way around the problem, because that's the way they have to do most things in their life. So how welcoming is the company and vendor to people with disabilities? Do they provide priority? Do they have a place on their website? Yes. You know, if you have an accessibility question, here's where you call. If you have an accessibility issue, here's the contact person or the procedure to report a problem or a bug.
So we wanted to talk a bit about some of the collaborations that we have been involved with, just to sort of give you a feel for how they work, just the logistics of them. Blackboard is the one that I've been most closely involved with. And are the Blackboard folks here? I thought I recognized your voice. this is actually a very long-standing collaboration since 94, 95, John tells me. John was one of the early pioneers in working with WebCT. And it has evolved considerably over time as new people have gotten involved, and there have been various other sort of stimuli that led to changes along the way. But for many years, and even after the merger, WebCT and Blackboard, there was kind of one central person who was the Blackboard liaison, and the Blackboard Accessibility Interest Group, or WebCT Accessibility Interest Group, would provide information to that particular person. And then they would you know, see that it got to the right places within Blackboard. But we never really had a sense for, you know, what was happening with that information after we shared it with our one contact. So within just kind of the last two or three years, that has really morphed quite a bit. And so we have a number of people at the table in Blackboard. And you know, we meet on a regular basis. We have a discussion list. It's kind of a general list for issues related to Blackboard accessibility. There are 145 subscribers to that at last count. There may be more than that since I last knew what the number was. But and that's it kind of comes and goes in terms of how much traffic is active on that list. But we have kind of a subgroup who is very actively engaged in you know, walking through different workflow scenarios that Blackboard provides and kind of evaluating product pretty early on in the development cycle. And we have developers who join us from Blackboard as well. And so the questions that we're being asked to address, you know, are fairly high level you know, accessibility questions about emerging kinds of features. And so I think you know, it has sort of, you know, evolved, the collaboration has evolved, but I feel like at this point it's a lot more productive than it probably has been in the past. And on a couple slides from now, John, I think, is going to talk a little bit about, you know, maybe one of the stimuli that sort of led to that, but I'll touch upon it briefly. And that is that the California State University system, anybody here from California State? We actually had a panelist who was supposed to join us from California State, the Chancellor's office, and she was not able to get funds to travel, which might be another reason why we're not seeing a whole lot of people from California. They have an accessible technology initiative, which at the Chancellor's office level requires that technology be accessible. And that has actually had a huge impact when you think about how many campuses and how much money is at stake within the Cal State system. Blackboard and Desire to Learn actually did not make the cut when they evaluated courseware products they essentially were on the do not buy list based on accessibility. And that got Blackboard's attention, that got other vendors' attention, and really led, I think, to some positive changes to work toward accessibility and make sure, you know, that customers such as California State University, you know, would be able to purchase the product based on accessibility. And so that really has powerful implications, I think, for all of us in higher education that, you know, we've tried. I've been in this field for close to 20 years now and have tried, you know, a lot of efforts to persuade people to build accessible products. But ultimately, maybe it comes down to, you know, we're not going to buy your product unless it meets our accessibility criteria. And, you know, if enough institutions assume that stance, you know, and as you're interacting with vendors here at EDUCAUSE, asking questions about how accessible are you, you know, and really trying to spread that message and make sure that it's heard, then, you know, maybe that can have an impact.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about Desire to Learn. Our collaboration with Desire to Learn started in June of 2006, and it was about a year prior that Ohio State had chosen Desire to Learn as their LMS system. And we had some very good initial relations with the company, and so it wasn't very difficult to get started up. There was a meeting of Big Ten schools focused on accessibility that coincided with our collaboration effort, and the history of it is we've done a series of evaluations of their product from the 7.4 generation to the current generation, and have even looked at things that they have in development. So this is something that I think has a lot of value for institutions thinking about an LMS. They've opened up their sort of development, not even beta stuff that just the developers were looking at for us to examine and to comment on. And that's been very productive. We meet now every month. We used to meet every 2 weeks. We did a series of very detailed evaluations. We would do the evaluation, then we would discuss them. And from our evaluations, an issues list was created. And we try to keep it up to date. Because this isn't the only thing that I do in my job, and everybody on who's part of this collaboration, there's people from University of Arizona and people from Guelph in Canada. We have some members from the UK, about a total of 52 people, maybe 10 of whom participate regularly. Because of everybody's to-do list in their home institutions, you know, we can't always produce a new evaluation for every single product that comes out. And so what's ended up happening over the last year is Desire to Learn's kind of taken the reins, and they're now hosting the collaboration sessions, the teleconferences that we have, footing the bill for phone. Which is, you know, I guess not all that much considering, you know, they're getting a lot of free help. Definitely doing a lot internally to try to drive accessibility as something that's important within the company. I think the future of this particular collaboration is kind of maintenance driven. We will look at new products and things like that, but it seems like one of the things that's happened during this collaboration is the company now gets it, whereas before I think they may have thought about it, but it wasn't very high on the radar, and now they get it. They will do things like implement cutting edge standards before we even tell them that it's something they should think about. And so that's very nice to see, and I think is a success for the whole notion of collaborating with vendors. So, John?
One of the collaborations that we were interested in is library resources, because that's a basic educational requirement. So one of the companies we contacted was a company called EBSCO. And they're basically a bibliographic database service, so collecting articles and resources. And this was a really great group to work for, because they were really looking for accessibility feedback. They had tried to do some things for accessibility, didn't really understand a lot about accessibility, but when we started working with them and making suggestions on how they... We also happened to catch them at a time where they were in the process of redesigning their website. One of the interesting little features was that they had a text-only version, which was a popular accessibility feature. They had a text-only version of their website, and they saw it was getting a huge amount of hits. You know, well, wow, we have a lot of people with disabilities trying to access our website. Wow. Well, they traced back the IPs. Anybody want to guess where the IPs were coming from, IP addresses? China. China had very poor bandwidth, and so they wanted the text only. They didn't care about all the fancy pictures and all the fancy table markup. Hey, they just wanted the content. So we started working with them on redesigning their website, and we'd have comments like, well, I don't think we can do that one for maybe 2 or 3 months. Is that okay? Hey, okay. but they were going to put it in there. And it's funny. After they redesigned their website based on the best practices that we were talking to them about and working with them on, their redesigned website, their standard page was half the weight or half the size of their previous text-only pages. So, and what's the number one usability thing on the web? Usability issue on the web, what's the number one? Speed, right? If your page takes more than 2 seconds to load, people will think there's something wrong with your website. So web standards-based accessible designs can help everybody in terms of usability. And that's one of the things we advocate in all of these collaborations, is the use of standards, web standards, and to improve the experience for everybody, including people with disabilities. So here was a company that was waiting for accessibility feedback and wasn't getting any. And when they got it, they ate it up. Other bibliographic services, though, were different. We were working with Elsevier, and their usability and design people were all for accessibility. They wanted to do it. But the problem was upper management said, well, there's higher priorities. And where does upper management get their higher priorities? Do they make it up themselves? We have some companies in here. You guys don't make up your priorities. You go to your customers, right? Your customers set your priorities. And that was a case even where the people telling EBSCO what they wanted wasn't accessibility. So the university's administrations weren't making it a priority. I know our head librarian brought it up with Elsevier at one point, and she was in a room with a bunch of other people, and there was dead silence. There was nobody there supporting her, and that's another aspect of web access, of making products accessible, and I think illustrated by what Terry was saying with the California State University system. Here is where management took a stand, spent the time to evaluate and put some teeth into accessibility, making it more of a nice thing to do, to saying, well, it's a critical feature for us to do. And so with Elsevier, they didn't get the support, and I don't know where it stands now. But two different tales. So I think what I'd like to say is many companies want accessibility feedback. They want to know how to make their products better, And so as consumers of those technologies, we need to provide that. We also need to have the upper management support in our university to make it a priority for the companies. Oh, okay, back to me. Okay. So what can we do? So, you know, this is a call to action, and these won't cost you any money, okay? We've got a whole room full of vendors down the hall here that you guys can go march. We have some vendors here, so maybe you'll have the answers to these questions when some people come to your companies. But, you know, go by, you know, you can look at the VPATs, and we looked at some VPAT stuff here. And I mean, that's the first thing to ask a company, do they have a VPAT? And take a look at it, okay? But some of the other things you can say, okay, well, what's the coding practices that you use for accessibility? Do you have design criteria that you give to your web developers or your software developers, things that they have to follow? Most companies have coding practices for lots of things. Do you have some for accessibility? It's not a new concept to companies to have internal coding practices. What are their coding practices for accessibility? Do you include accessibility testing as part of your internal process? Or are they waiting until after you build the product and do external testing, or just figure that it's accessible because we read the guidelines to the Section 508 at one point to our developers and we assume that they use them? Do they include people with disabilities in actually testing your product? You know, that's really the bottom line of 508. One of the less read parts of 508, you know, everybody knows the technical standards, but 508 has a functional requirement. You have to show how people with disabilities can actually use your product. That's one of the reasons why the requirements are so minimal, is to allow companies to innovate, to make products that not only meet the requirements, but make their product usable to people with disabilities. What product features do they test for? So like Ken was saying, you know, the desire to learn VPAT, they say where they don't meet them, and they may not have a solution right now. But these are the areas we do have a solution. And if you can help us on the areas we don't have a solution, we'd love to work with you, you know, potentially. If you have more detailed information, you can now start to compare products truly and make accessibility a factor. I know a few years ago, we brought in a bunch of learning management system vendors to come in, and part of the questions were related to accessibility. And they actually had scoring for accessibility, so we could get points. Accessibility could get points towards the purchase of the product. But all the products brought in didn't meet our accessibility requirements. So it became a wash. I mean, you couldn't say go for product A because they really know accessibility. None of the products really understood accessibility. So it doesn't help in that situation. But at least it was points, so companies saw that. So I think some of these things we've already covered here a little bit, so maybe we can move to the next slide. I think, okay, so
open source. Okay, I'm going to make this quick. All the collaborations we've talked about so far have been with vendors that protect their source code. And so, what impact can you have if your institution decides to go with an open source product, such as, and we're talking about my work is mostly with learning management systems, so Sakai is an open source example. Moodle would be another open source example. The thing that I would say is whereas it might seem at first blush that you can get a lot more out of an open source product because you can take the source code and if you've got internal developers, modify it to your own liking. A lot of these systems are so complex, especially something like a learning management system, such a complex piece of technology, that unless you've got really solid developers internal to your own institution, you're probably not going to have a lot of luck modifying things locally. Now, that's not always the case, and one of the things that's nice about open source is if you do come up with a local solution, you can submit it back to the community and see whether or not they will take it into the core of their product. It's not going to do you a lot of good just to spin off something locally and then submit it back and have it languish in a branch of their development tree. So you're going to have to work internally with the community to try to get them to recognize the improvements that you've made. But you know, in essence, you've got two sort of things. You've got an open source product, mainly being driven by the passion of the community, and with no profit motive. Well, if you can make the argument that accessibility is really crucial to your institution to a vendor, and you've got a large institution, then you can sort of by way of profit motive, instill passion in a privately owned company. And once they do that, the commitments tend to be more long-standing. In an open source project, you have people volunteering their time, coming and going, you might have a core of developers, but maybe the accessibility people are shuttling out. If a company makes a commitment to accessibility and they start to put it in writing and it starts to filter through their documentation, they're done. They have to support that commitment from that point on.
In this last slide, I think one of the things is we need to start managing accessibility. I liken accessibility similar to security issues. Nobody likes to think about security. Everybody wishes, boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if this internet was always, you know, secure and information was private when I just want it to be private and it's open when I want it to be open, and that there aren't people out there who are trying to hack into our systems. So there's a lot of resources allocated to security. We need that same type of commitment to accessibility. Accessibility isn't going to happen just because we wish it, or just because, well, the longer we, you know, I've had some developers say, well, the longer I develop it, the more accessible it gets, doesn't it? But, well, what principles are you using? Well, isn't just programming, the longer you spend on a product, make it more accessible? You know, I don't know where people get ideas, but we need to have resources allocated, whether it's if you're working with a company to help companies evaluate and understand the accessibility of their product, or if you're working with open source and trying to do your own modifications or set accessibility standards, we need resources allocated if we're going to make a difference. And that means an institutional commitment. Many universities set accessibility policies, but they don't back it up with any enforcement. So they have policies, but they don't commit the resources to audit their even their own internal resources, let alone working with vendors and companies. And that's a critical thing that we're going to need to really put teeth, I think, in accessibility. Certainly, we mentioned the California state system as kind of a highlight of where purchasing policies made a huge difference in accessibility. And so these are some of the things that we need to do to improve accessibility. It's going to take an investment. It's going to take commitment, just like people have to deal with like security issues and other issues that come up. This slide is basically just some resources that all of us have used in working with collaborations. One of the things that we have at the University of Illinois is the Web Accessibility Best Practices. We have a weekly meeting where we talk about these things. Everybody's invited, including developers, if they want to. We'd love to have developers. It's a coordination of developers, people with disabilities, IT accessibility professionals working together to find common solutions that work for everybody and practically for developers. Because we want solutions that developers can embrace and can say, yeah, this makes sense to me and hopefully makes sense to all of our customers. The Firefox accessibility extension was used for a lot of the California State University evaluation. It's a free extension to the Firefox. And also the Illinois Functional Accessibility Evaluator. And there's a brochure on the back table back here outlining these resources and also more information about how to join some of the collaboration groups if you're interested. There's also a sign-up list if you'd like to get more information about some of the products available from ICETA, including courses and trainings that's available.
We also have the, at the University of Washington, we have an accessible IT kind of central central site managed by the UW technology folks, and quite a few additional resources there. I'll just talk about WebAIM is a wonderful resource for all sorts of things related to web accessibility for people at all levels of expertise. And a couple of the products that we particularly like are the WAVE, which is an accessibility evaluation tool. That's available as an online version, and they also have a WAVE toolbar. All of these URLs and all the slides that you see are available. We've uploaded this to the EDUCAUSE site, so you can access this in either PowerPoint or PDF if you want those URLs. There also are some opportunities to get involved. First of all, just tomorrow, the IT Accessibility Constituent Group within EDUCAUSE is meeting tomorrow at 4:55. And I encourage you to come to that. That is in room 608. And we'll be talking probably collaboration with vendors will be one of the topics on the agenda. But basically, this group formed a couple of years ago with kind of the overall goal of spreading the word of accessibility within EDUCAUSE. And we have a variety of different efforts underway within EDUCAUSE to do just that. And so it'll be still a young group, so it's a really great opportunity to talk about whatever's on your mind and to kind of steer the direction of this group and of EDUCAUSE related to accessibility. We also have a wiki that we created specifically for this particular session that focuses on collaborations on accessibility. So one of the key organizations that's involved is ATHN, which is the Assistive Technology and Higher Education Network. And their website is athenpro.org. And it's also one of the resources listed on the EDUCAUSE wiki because that's kind of the go-to organization now if you are interested in working collaboratively with other vendors, or if you're a vendor who's wanting to work more collaboratively with the accessibility community, then ATHN kind of, is providing that, central hub for getting the parties together who have like interests. There's also, just down the road, or up the road, Accessing Higher Ground next week, and I know at least a few of us are going to be sticking around and going to that, but University of Colorado Boulder has hosted this for, I think it's the 11th or 12th year this year, and coincidentally it coincided the week after EDUCAUSE and in the same general vicinity. So but it's a great conference focusing specifically on technology accessibility within a higher education context. So it's kind of a narrow focus, but as a result of that, some very rich discussions and great networking opportunities happen at that event. And there's also the CSUN, California State University Northridge, Conference on Accessibility and Assistive Technology, and that happens every year in March in Southern California. So I encourage you to get involved in all of these activities. And we still have, I believe, a few minutes anyway for anything you guys want to talk about. 6 minutes. Yes.
You guys want to talk about what you're doing on your campuses?
So there's fairly extensive training for learning the LMS for faculty and instructors. Accessibility is a component of it. We also use some of Desire2Learn's own documentation that we helped create for how to use their WYSIWYG editors and things of that nature in order to produce an accessible result. I think there could be more, and at least at Ohio State, we're currently undergoing a massive IT restructuring, we've been brought in to collaborate with what's called the Digital Union, which is sort of the front end of IT at the university, or is becoming the front end of IT at the university, and we'll be putting on workshops throughout the quarter. Beyond that, there's not a ton of support. My own office, we do a lot of collaborations with instructors and faculty and developers on campus, and so we do lots of one-on-one sessions. It's an initial effort, and I think probably in the long run, it'll become richer. Right now, there is some, of course, you know, doing what I do, I'd like to see more always. John?
I think whenever you're talking about instructors, that's a huge issue. And I think that the strategy we need to improve accessibility, while training is a component, I think training, at least in my experience, usually doesn't do a lot because people forget it, people didn't understand it. There are some efforts on our campus to include some accessibility training, but it's usually not people's first priority unless they have a student with a disability in their class. And even then, it's not often a very high priority. What we do need in terms of tool developers is awareness. People, the first step is that if people know what they're doing isn't accessible. Right now there's plausible deniability. I use your tool and the default way that I use it or the default way it works is, you know, is inaccessible. People have plausible deniability still. Well, I didn't know my content was inaccessible. You know, the university provided me with this tool. They're the ones who set the policy. Why would they provide a tool if it's not accessible? So I think the first thing, and one of the things we are working on with the Blackboard, is to provide a way for people to know what they're doing is not accessible. So if I upload a document or if I create something, that they get some feedback that there's accessibility problems with what they're doing. The second most important, and I think that builds awareness, so we can start to at least start addressing the issue, and people can't say, I didn't know. And that's one of the reasons why we developed some of our tools, because people could say, I didn't know, but now they can't say they didn't know. The second most important part is once we build awareness, we can start looking at, well, how do we design tools where things are accessible by default? I have to do something hard to make something inaccessible. So it's got to be easier to make accessible stuff. And right now we have the opposite. Typically with the tools that are provided, people have to have a lot of specialized knowledge. They have to know about accessibility requirements. It's very difficult. And there's a few people who are willing to make those steps. But, you know, Joe average faculty member or Jill average faculty member isn't going to understand a lot of those features. But if we provide them with a tool that creates, I mean, the goal is creating great online instructional content that's also highly accessible. Just like we did with the web accessibility best practices, we create accessible web content that's not only highly accessible, but it's more usable and flexible for everybody else. That's the holy grail in the instructional area. And we need to work with companies to understand that and provide that and see a demand for it.
Well, I mean, you know, if the campus has a commitment to best practices, I mean, and if you just sort of, you know, if you sort of under the wire slip accessibility into your discussions, like this is the way you do a synchronous presentation, right? And you train them and never mention accessibility. You're at your goal. Because people get funny around the term of accessibility. You know, like this is low on the list because it touches so few individuals, and I'm not interested in it because I don't have any kids with disabilities in my classes. But if you can take the other tack and just incorporate accessibility covertly in all of your training, then you're going to get there. But I also agree very much with John. If the tool doesn't have at least baseline accessibility, it's game over. And this is really very much true with synchronous learning environments. And we've looked at a number of them. And the ones that have high accessibility tend not to appeal to faculty because not because of the fact that they're accessible, but because they're unexciting as products. Whereas something that has very relatively low accessibility, say something like Adobe Connect, everybody wants it because it's slick. You know, so slick, accessible technology, that's the goal.
You can continue the conversation. Ron, Terry?
Well, certainly after the session, we're happy to stick around for a little bit and talk further. And then hopefully you all wrote down the tomorrow at 4:15
55, the IT Accessibility Constituent Group. So hope to see all of you there. I've just changed the slide, too, to go online to the EDUCAL site and click on Evaluate the Session to provide some feedback regarding this session. And thank you all for attending. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
This EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.